From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, the consequences of the Comey indictment after President Trump says he wants more. And Ron Elving on the Week in Politics. A chat with a man in the midst of pumpkins. Janice Hallett's new mystery set on quiz nights in an English pub. The killer question. And America Ferrera of the Lost Bus, taken from the true story of a teacher and school bus driver who brings students to safety during deadly wildfires.
I deeply wanted what was important to her about the journey she'd been on that bus with those children and Kevin, to survive in the film.
First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, September 27th, 2025.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. Minnesota regulators are considering testimony they heard Thursday on a proposed acquisition that could set a new tone in the world of public utilities. A decision is expected soon on whether Minnesota Power should be sold to a private equity firm. The Public Utilities Commission votes next week on a petition for purchase of the utility by Global Infrastructure Partners. The Canada Pension Plan Investment Board would be minority owners. A recent settlement with the State Commerce Department added some conditions, but Maggie Schupert with the rural community advocacy group CURE says they still worry the new owners will focus on profits, setting a dangerous precedent.
Clearly, if this deal goes through, private equity interests, they see the arguments against it shot down, they're going to know that our utility sector across the country is open for business.
Schupert and other opponents contend that because of how the deal is structured, ratepayers could face higher utility bills. Utility officials say the new owners would give them financial flexibility to meet the state's mandate for carbon-free electricity by 2040. In a non-binding opinion this summer, an administrative law judge said the deal would not be in the public's interest. The PUC vote is expected October 3rd. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. An attempt to create a new statewide nonprofit health system with the University of Minnesota and Fairview and Essentia Health Systems has ended. Chelsea Perkins explains.
The Minnesota Star Tribune reports that people close to the negotiations who were not authorized to speak on the record said there was an impasse over the proposed structure, leading to Essentia Health exiting the talks. This leaves the U with limited time to create a new agreement for the long-term future of the medical school with its current partner, Fairview Health Services, which is set to expire at the end of 2026. The university operates the state's largest and only public training program for physicians, and the medical school uses Fairview's University of Minnesota Medical Center as its primary teaching hospital. The Essentia Health proposal was announced in January and called for creating an all-Minnesota health system solution that would include a $1 billion joint investment over 5 years. A person close to the talks said Essentia opted out of negotiations after it became clear Fairview would not merge into a proposed new nonprofit health system led by Essentia. In a statement shared with KAXE on Thursday, Essentia Health confirmed it is no longer part of the mediation through the Attorney General's office. Essentia says this is because the strategic facilitator determined the provider no longer had a role in the process. But they say that process is distinct from broader conversations happening with the university to support the medical school in, quote, preparing the current and future healthcare workforce. Chelsea Perkins, KAXE News.
Leech Lake Tribal Council members, Itasca County Commissioners, and even State Senator Mary Kunish broke ground Friday for a new community and wellness center in Ball Club. It's the third such groundbreaking this year, following the state legislature's 2023 investment for three wellness centers on the Leech Lake Reservation. Kunish says the investment was long overdue.
They will take our land and in exchange provide housing, health care, education, opportunity to, you know, have a trade that would be able to be sustainable for our communities. And we know that our federal government and even our state government never really upheld those agreements.
Ball Club's representative on the Tribal Council, Kyle Smith, says these centers serve a huge role in Indigenous communities.
Our communities are very tight-knit. You know, we rely on families for supports and family gatherings. Mm-hmm. And it's just a way of life for our Native communities.
The Leech Lake Band also formally entered into a memorandum of understanding with Itasca County, which Commissioner John Johnson commemorated with a special gift to Chairman Farron Jackson.
I hope that that this unfinished pipe is as meaningful to you and the council as it is to me, because I hope it is exactly like the relationship between Itasca County and the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, and that it remains unfinished.
Construction on the new wellness centers is expected to take about 1 year. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. Justice, as in the U.S. Justice Department, can move swiftly. A week ago today, President Trump publicly called on the DOJ to prosecute his perceived political enemies, including the former FBI Director James Comey. On Thursday, prosecutors followed through and secured a criminal indictment against James Comey for false statements and obstruction. NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas. Ryan Lucas joins us. Ryan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
What is the indictment allege?
Well, look, it's very much a bare bones indictment. It's just a page and a half long, but it contains the two counts you mentioned, one for false statements, the other for obstruction of a congressional proceeding. Now, these charges stem from testimony that Comey gave to the Senate Judiciary Committee in September of 2020, so about 5 years ago. That hearing revolved around the FBI's investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 election. The indictment says that Comey lied by denying that he had authorized someone at the FBI to leak information. That appears to be a reference to an exchange at that hearing between Comey and Texas Republican Ted Cruz. Cruz asked Comey whether he had authorized someone at the FBI to be an anonymous source in news reports. Comey gave only a brief reply. He told Cruz that he stood by the answer that he had given back in 2017, which was that he had not authorized any such leak.
And what do you think we should make of the timing of this indictment, given what the president had said just a week ago?
I think the timing is a really important aspect here. You mentioned the demand the president made 1 week ago. Today, in essence, instructing Attorney General Pam Bondi by name to investigate specific people he doesn't like, Trump named three people in that post to be prosecuted: New York Attorney General Letitia James, California Democratic Senator Adam Schiff, and James Comey. Now, the case against Comey was being handled by the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Eastern District of Virginia. Last week, Trump pushed out the top federal prosecutor there, in part because that prosecutor had expressed doubts about the strength of the case against Comey. Trump then installed Lindsey Halligan to replace him. Halligan has no prosecutorial experience, but she did once serve as a personal attorney for Trump, and she had been working in the White House. Halligan then pushed through the indictment against Comey over the objections of career prosecutors in the U.S. Attorney's Office there, who also had concerns about the strength of the evidence in this case.
Now that James Comey's been indicted, what did the president have to say?
Well, Trump was asked about it yesterday when he was leaving the White House. He was asked who would be next on his list of retribution. You can hear the helicopter in the background here, but here's a bit of what he said.
It's not a list, but I think there'll be others. I mean, they're corrupt. These were corrupt, radical left Democrats, because Comey essentially was he's worse than a Democrat.
Now, Trump has insulted Comey for years. He did it again yesterday. He called him a dirty cop. Now, after the indictment was made public, Comey also put out a video on Instagram. Here's a bit of what he said.
My family and I have known for years that there are costs to standing up to Donald Trump, but we couldn't imagine ourselves living any other way. We will not live on our knees, and you shouldn't either.
Comey also declared his innocence, said he has confidence in the federal judicial system, and he said, let's have a trial.
Finally, does this signal anything for the second Trump term?
Well, look, traditionally, the Justice Department has enjoyed independence from the White House, particularly when it comes to investigations and prosecutions, because you want to be sure that prosecutions and investigations aren't driven by and don't appear to be driven by politics. Here in just the past week, we have the president openly calling for the attorney general to go after people Trump doesn't like, including James Comey. Now Comey's been indicted. So for legal observers and Justice Department veterans, this sure looks like Trump using the Justice Department to enact the campaign of retribution that he promised.
And Judge Ryan Lucas, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now we turn to NPR senior political contributor Ron Elving. Ron, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
How significant do you believe is this indictment?
We're seeing the depth of resentment the president still seems to feel about the start of his first term. That was when Comey asserted the independence of the Justice Department, as Ryan Lucas was just telling us. You may recall how Trump suggested Comey could go easy on one of Trump's allies and early appointees. Comey pushed back, and the relationship soured quickly. Trump fired Comey, prompting many people to conclude that Trump did not understand that the DOJ was not his to order about like an in-house lawyer. So in significance, this current indictment may say more about the Trump administration than it does about Comey. And while it may well be a personal and financial burden for the former FBI director, it is highly unlikely to lead to a conviction, and it may not even get to a trial. Now, we heard a chorus of the president's usual supporters in certain media coming out to call this indictment weak. Moreover, the prospect of a trial that brings out the facts about what Trump did and what Trump didn't do and what Comey did back 10 years ago is not likely to bathe the president in a flattering light.
President Trump addressed the UN General Assembly earlier this week. Didn't hold back, did he?
The president seemed genuinely annoyed by a balky escalator that stopped just as he got on, and then by a teleprompter that malfunctioned. He also seemed upset about one of his companies losing out on a bid to renovate the UN building years ago. But, of course, he also went well beyond the merely peevish and personal with his assault on other countries and their handling of immigration. Let's listen.
It's time to end the failed experiment of open borders. You have to end it now. See, I can tell you, I'm really good at this stuff. Your countries are going to hell.
So, on one hand, Trump seems to be bearding the United Nations lion right in its own den. But his real audience there may be far outside the UN itself. He knows that organization and other international entities are not popular with his own voters. They delight in hearing him disrespect the UN. They believe the United States has been taken advantage of by the United Nations and many of its members. And they are glad to hear someone say so and insist on greater respect for the U.S.
Ron, next week, can a government shutdown be averted? And if not, what might it look like?
It's hard to see how they can avoid it now. Both sides at least seem to have decided to have the shutdown. Trump, because he thinks it will empower him to do as he wishes and strengthen his standing with voters. Democrats seem resigned to a shutdown because anything more cooperative would make them look weak, or worse yet, make them look like enablers for Trump. So they've chosen to take a stand over health care spending. Now, Democrats could have shut the government down back in March, and some say they should have, that nothing was gained by going along. And that sentiment seems to be dominating right now in the opposition party.
Politically, what implications do you think it has for both parties? Who'll get the blame if there is a shutdown?
It's usually easier for the president to dominate the debate about a shutdown. The White House can speak with a single authoritative voice. Meanwhile, the opposition consists of scores of different people and coalitions, and it can be nearly impossible to get all the Democrats on the same rhetorical program at the same time. That enables the president and his party to say, look, we gave this all the votes we had, but we don't have 60, and that's the magic number to cut off debate, so we need a few of you Democrats to come over and help us keep the government open. It's easier for politicians to mischaracterize their opposition sometimes than it is to formulate a policy of their own that actually pleases swing voters. And this is happening at a time when many other issues are in the news and pulling voters in different directions and distracting them makes it all the harder to explain a complex budget process.
And NPR's Ron Elving, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
In 1977, a neo-Nazi group called the National Socialist Party of America applied for a permit to march through Skokie, Illinois, predominantly Jewish Chicago suburb. They wanted to wear brown shirts with swastika armbands and wave signs demanding free speech for white people. The village refused the permit, the group sued, and it ignited a national debate over the First Amendment that may sound familiar today. Does the constitutional right to free speech protect offensive, even hateful speech? Can words cause real damage? Skokie's attorneys argued that seeing the swastika and hearing chants of Sieg Heil on their streets would amount to a physical attack on the hundreds of Holocaust survivors who lived in Skokie. I remember speaking with Magda Brown over iced tea on her porch. She'd been a teenager in Hungary when the Nazi-aligned government began making anti-Jewish laws. She survived Auschwitz and Buchenwald. Her family was executed. The thought of Nazis in our streets today, she told me, brings back my worst fears. I told Magda Brown that the young Chicago Nazis I'd interviewed in their small storefront headquarters looked more ridiculous than menacing. Magda Brown answered, "That's what the Nazis looked like to us in 1933, too. That was the year Hitler came to power in Germany. David Goldberger was the ACLU lawyer who argued in the U.S. Supreme Court for the right of the neo-Nazis to march and speak. But our real client was always the First Amendment, he told us this week. The courts eventually ruled that the planned demonstration was protected speech, but the Nazis ended up holding the rally in Chicago instead. David Goldberger, who's now professor emeritus at the Ohio State University's Law School, found the case personally painful. He himself is Jewish. "I still feel bad about the pain it caused survivors," he said. "People who had suffered so much, I felt like they could be my uncles and relatives. But when free speech is denied because someone finds it offensive," he says today, "then officials can prevent speech, even jokes that anyone dislikes for any reason. Free speech doesn't work just when you agree with it." Maybe there's some unity in that thought in these divided times. And you're listening to NPR News.
It's 7:18. You're listening to Weekend Edition on People-Powered KAXE. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 9 o'clock, it's Stay Human. This week, live storytelling from last week's Authentic Voice event. Laura Nimi takes his life in his hands, Teresa Alto goes to the county jail, and Michael Goldberg almost makes it to the fabulous island of Crete. Story and song for Spirit and Courage, that is this morning at 9. You can also catch it tomorrow evening at 5 o'clock. We receive support from the Blandin Foundation Strengthening Rural Minnesota. More at blandinfoundation.org. Loon Country Arts hosts the Great Northern Art Show today from 11 to 4 at the Beltrami County History Center in Bemidji. Meet local artists and explore jewelry, paintings, photography, and more. And you can learn about a year in the life of North America's woodpeckers at the Saks Zim Bog near Meadowlands. That's today at 2 o'clock. Meet at the Lois King Education Center.
Da, 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 da.
Start your day off on the right note with Morning Edition from NPR News. Listen every weekday.
Morning Edition begins at 5 a.m. Monday through Friday here on KAXE, people-powered radio for northern Minnesota. So many local conversations as well, like Area Voices and The Bright Spot and events up north. And programs that have been around forever that you, too, can sing along to, like The Sports Page and What's for Breakfast. Thanks for keeping us here. Get us into the future with your donation now. Text the word DONATE to 218-326-1234. Keep us humming along.
It don't matter if you tall.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. From Dignity Memorial. For many families, remembering loved ones means honoring the details that made them unique. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to compassion in every detail of a life celebration. DignityMemorial.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Americans are concerned about crime, but they do not broadly support President Trump's deployment of the National Guard to police U.S. cities. That is the finding of a new NPR Ipsos poll on law enforcement. And as NPR's Debbie Elliott reports, there's a significant partisan divide over the president's crime-fighting tactics.
President Trump's continued use of the National Guard has drawn protests in Washington, D.C. And a federal judge ruled the deployment of troops to Los Angeles is illegal. Still, Trump is pushing ahead to expand the practice as a way to crack down on crime.
I'm signing a presidential memorandum to establish the Memphis Safe Task Force, and it's very important because of the crime that's going on, not only in Memphis, in many cities, and we're going to take care of all of them, step by step, just like we did in D.C. We have.
He's threatened to send troops to other Democratic-led cities, including Chicago, New Orleans, and Baltimore. The new NPR Ipsos poll indicates that people are worried about crime, says the polling firm's vice president, Mallory Newell.
It's a pretty widely held belief. Around 7 in 10 Americans say that the level of crime and violence in American cities is at an unacceptable level.
Crime overall, including violent crime, is down significantly from pandemic-era highs across the U.S., but Newell says that doesn't bear out in public perception.
While the American public largely agrees that crime has increased in the U.S. and in major cities, they don't broadly support the actions taken in the name of stopping crime, like calling in the National Guard.
For instance, about half of those polled oppose deploying National Guard troops to their town or a major city in their states. Not surprisingly, Newell says, there's a major split along party lines.
About 8 in 10 Republicans support something like that, and almost the same number of Democrats oppose. So there is a significant partisan divide here.
The divide also shows up in public opinion about the continued deployment of National Guard troops in the nation's capital.
They're there for show. Totally unnecessary.
That's Democrat Les Blackmore. He's among the 1,020 people Ipsos interviewed between September 19th and 21st. The poll has a margin of error of plus or minus 3.2 percentage points. Blackmore is a retiree who lives in Lee's Summit, Missouri, a suburb of Kansas City. He says the Guard deployments feel like an occupation.
Are we really going there? It's not America to me to see that a national force policing everyday lives of Americans on our streets and highways. No, it's not America.
Republicans are more likely to accept Trump's tactics. The poll finds that 93% of Republicans say crime and violence is unacceptably high. Bianca Galagos is a stay-at-home mom in Pocatello, Idaho.
I think the biggest issue in America today we faced was crime. Just a lot of killings and drugs and gang-related.
Gallego says she would not want the National Guard in her community, but supports deployments in Washington, D.C. and Memphis.
I think those two places are pretty bad in their crime rate. And if that's something Trump feels needs to be done, then I think it should be done.
Trump does not have that level of support from independents in the poll. More than half oppose using troops to fight crime.
I truly think it's an abuse of power.
Independent Darius Gamble works in HR and lives in Gardendale, Alabama, just outside Birmingham.
calling out the National Guard, I think it's truly excessive. I think it's unwarranted. I don't think it's needed. And I think it's just an overreach in regards to POTUS abusing his power and authority.
He's using the acronym POTUS for President of the United States. Gamble says he voted for Trump in hopes that he would bring down prices and improve the business climate. He's disappointed with the administration's focus.
You can deploy military reserves, whoever, but that's still not addressing the real issue, which is we just have way too many guns on the street, and there's not enough opportunities in regards to individuals.
His biggest worry is the economy, and that was the number one response on the NPR Ipsos poll, followed by political polarization and then crime. Newell says concern about political extremism and polarization has jumped by about 15 percentage points since May.
What that tells me is that in this current moment, the public is really on edge about the divides in our society and the fractured political environment that exists.
A divide borne out in the way people view the use of military forces to police American cities. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
A landmark trade deal between the U.S. and 32 African nations is set to expire next week. The African Growth and Opportunity Act, known as AGOA, was passed into law 25 years ago under President Clinton, and it's received bipartisan support over the years.
We believe that by removing a crippling debt burden, we'll help millions of Africans improve their lives and grow their economies.
That was President George W. Bush in 2005, and here's President Obama in 2015 when AGOA was last renewed.
Africa is a place of incredible dynamism, some of the fastest growing markets in the world.
But the fate of AGOA is now uncertain. The deadline for renewing it is on Tuesday. Reuben Brigidy served as the U.S. ambassador to South Africa and to the African Union under Presidents Obama and President Biden. Ambassador Brigidy joins us now in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
How does AGOA work?
So AGOA is, although it uses trade, it really is a development program. And the idea is that for those countries that are eligible, if you don't have tariffs placed on some goods that they export to the United States, the idea of a tariff-free ability to export will create the incentives for those countries to actually develop industries on those goods, on everything from apparel, engine parts, and whatever else. And that will then create jobs, bolstering their economies, and therefore decrease the need for external foreign assistance.
Has it made a difference over the years?
Well, yes and no. There certainly have been a number of countries in sub-Saharan Africa that have taken dramatic advantage of AGOA and have grown tens of thousands, in some places hundreds of thousands of jobs. A country like Kenya, for example, almost 88% of its exports to the United States under AGOA-eligible provisions have created tens of thousands of jobs. There's a factory in Kenya called UAL, for example, which helps to produce jeans and other things that are sold by H&M and Levi's. Or a tiny country called Lesotho, which is literally surrounded on all sides by South Africa. 99% of Lesotho's exports to the United States are AGOA-eligible. And so in places like that, and also places like Madagascar and Mauritius, it has made a real material impact. But one of the critiques of AGOA is that it has not had the catalytic impact on African manufacturing that it was intended, despite the fact that it's been in existence for almost a generation.
Does that put any merit into President Trump's approach, that it is better to deal with African states one by one rather than grouping them all together in one agreement?
First of all, AGOA is a unilateral concession. So we say to these sub-Saharan countries that are eligible, you can export 5,000 types of items to the United States and we will not put tariffs on them. Why would you want to renew it, given President Trump's predilection for tariffs? And the first reason is total exports to the United States under AGOA are about $9.7 billion worth of goods and services in 2023. That's just under AGOA. Total imports into the United States in that same year were $3.8 trillion. So $9.7 billion is a fraction of a part of a drop in the bucket, meaning that for the United States of America, we wouldn't even feel it. But for those people who are getting jobs and being able to transform their lives in Africa, it makes tremendous difference. The second reason is that even for those countries that have not actively utilized it enough, it is of enormous importance politically for them. The level of significance this has in terms of strengthening our political relationships with the continent are enormous. And this is at a time, quite frankly, where there is great geostrategic competition in Africa with other actors, principally China, and for AGOA to go away, it absolutely would hurt the position of the United States.
Would it hurt the position of the United States economically?
Well, there are certain things certainly that Americans benefit from AGOA. As an example, right, citrus from South Africa is often exported to the United States under AGOA. Some people won't be able to get the same amount of oranges at the same prices. But as a general matter, most Americans wouldn't feel it. But our African friends would. And that's part of the argument for renewing it, because Africa is the youngest continent in the world. Here we are in 2025. By the time we reach 2050, which is tomorrow, at least one quarter of humanity will be African, and somewhere between one third and one half of the global workforce on the planet will be African. That's not conjecture. Those people have already been born. Africa is the future, both in terms of critical minerals and a seismic geopolitical shift. We want those populations to prosper. We would like for them to be looking towards the United States as their partners of choice. And for the minimal price of extending the kind of trade provisions under AGOA, this is an easy win for us.
Reuben Brigidy is a former U.S. ambassador to South Africa and the African Union. Thanks so much for joining us in our studio.
Thank you so much.
Might not feel this way in a lot of the country, but we're almost 1 week into fall. And that means pumpkins in everything, your coffee, your cereal, possibly even your aftershave. And like so much else that is wonderful in this world, you can thank the great state of Illinois. According to the USDA, Illinois harvests more pumpkins than twice the next five states combined. How did that happen? We turn now to the man who owns the great pumpkin patch in Arthur, Illinois. Mac Condell joins us. Mr. Condell, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
And how long have you been in the pumpkin business, sir?
36 years, since I was 12 years old, believe it or not.
Oh, mercy. Congratulations. And has it grown since you've started?
Oh, yes. We started as a little farmside stand. Of course, that was the mid-80s, and that's when a lot of family farms were lost in corn and soybean country, and so people diversified. We planted 1 acre of pumpkins by hand. It took us 9 hours. I remember that day specifically. So out there, you know, crossing every digit you have on your body and hoping we could sell something. And then we were blessed that people in the community, people out of church came out and bought the extra pumpkins that we grew that year.
How many varieties of pumpkins, or squash, if you please?
We grow over 300 varieties, and we have grown well over 700 varieties in my lifetime.
How did Illinois become pumpkin central?
I think the conditions are just perfect for cucurbits. Cucurbits are a fancy name for pumpkin squash and gourds. It's a low vining crop that likes hot and dry. So even this year, in the middle of a very widespread drought, myself and other farmers in this area are sitting on a very, very strong pumpkin crop.
And I say this as a loyal son of Illinois. Are Illinois pumpkins markedly better than, say, Indiana pumpkins?
I would say yes. Yes. Honestly, the micronutrients that we have, so the boron and the molybdenum, goes into kind of the form of the pumpkin, and Illinois-grown pumpkin is extremely sturdy, got great coloration, and is just a really marketable product, more so than maybe our neighbors.
I have to ask. I don't want to put you on the spot.
Yeah.
When Halloween comes.
Yeah.
Can you see the great pumpkin rising from your patch?
You know what? I'm usually asleep the second we close, and so I very much think it happens, but I'm never awake to see it.
Aww. Mac Condell of the Great Pumpkin Patch in Arthur, Illinois, thanks so much for being with us, and our best wishes of what amounts to your holiday season. Thanks so much.
You bet. I appreciate it.
listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. President Trump's most outspoken Republican critic on Capitol Hill is facing enormous pressure to fold or pay the price. And now Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massie, a 12-year incumbent, is asking his constituents to fight an effort to oust him.
We need to have a second opinion on everything. Our founders set up a balance of government, and the balance of government is gone if you don't have a counterbalance within your own party.
That's Representative Massie, joined by Kentucky Senator Rand Paul to rally voters during a blitz of campaign stops in their state. And peer congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales traveled to northern Kentucky, but she's here in our studios now. Claudia, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to see you, Scott.
Congressman Massie and Senator Paul, who has been another prominent Trump critic on many issues, visited more than half a dozen communities. What did you hear?
Visit after visit, they told constituents that President Trump is one of the best presidents of their lifetimes, but they argued they're also part of the same Republican Party and there should be room for disagreement. Paul defended Massie, who is a longtime friend, as the last member of the Tea Party fighting for conservative values. I asked Paul to expand on what that means.
There'll be no more Tea Party. It's about the idea of limited government, and I'm all in for Thomas Massie.
And we should note Trump has also taken aim at Paul, but he's not up for re-election until 2028. However, in Massey's case, his seat will be contested like all House seats in next year's midterms.
Now, President Trump has repeatedly publicly attacked Massie and Paul for voting against his agenda. Why don't they fall in line like their colleagues?
Both Massie and Paul are cut from the same kind of Tea Party libertarian cloth, which is a contrast from the president, especially at this moment when the Republican-led Congress has shown great fealty to the president. So they're often on the opposite ends of the president when it comes to spending, tariffs, the First Amendment. And in Massie's case, he's leading a charge to force the release of the Jeffrey Epstein records. And both are also playing to this independent maverick Kentucky political brand and state of mind.
How did you see constituents receive Massie and Paul's messages?
I saw a whole range of reactions. Some were very loyal to Massie and Paul. Others were saying they've gone too far or that Trump has gone too far. I talked to one couple who showed up to an event wearing T-shirts that read, "I stand with Thomas Massie." I talked to Diane Olberding. She voted for Trump in the last election, and she feels betrayed.
These two guys here don't change their convictions. You know, talk is cheap, and we all know Mr. President Trump loves to talk, but he needs to continue what he was voted in on, MAGA.
Now, of course, President Trump has won Kentucky three elections in a row by double-digit margins. In fact, his highest percentage was in 2024. How big of a challenge could Massie face in his reelection campaign?
Well, it's unusual to launch a campaign for a congressional seat more than a year out this aggressively and with this level of spending, all for a primary race in a solidly red district. Massie thinks it's the most ever spent on a congressional race this early on. And the war chest amassed against him, which has been fueled by the president, Massie says it's raised millions. He also has repeatedly referenced these television ads that are already airing in those markets, accusing Massie of flag burning, which he said was a complete lie. But we should note Massie ran unopposed in 2024, so it will be hard to find a candidate who will be strong enough and have that kind of name ID to turn away voters from Massie.
And here's Claudia Grisales. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
It's 7:39. You're listening to Weekend Edition here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Our weather for today should be beautiful with sunny skies, highs in the upper 60s to low 70s, breezy northwest winds 10 to 20. Our lows tonight 43 to 50 and tomorrow sunny, highs in the mid to upper 70s. Looking ahead to Monday, even warmer, highs 77 to 81 with sunny skies. Hooking up a car seat, it can be tricky. Are you positive your child's car seat is installed correctly? Now is the time to be overprotective. Drive smart and get your precious cargo home safely. A message from the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Beltrami County Historical Society in Bemidji hosts an author reading this evening, 6 o'clock. Hear readings from the new edition of North Country Journal, which features stories of remarkable Beltrami County women. Thanks for tuning in this morning. There is more ahead from Weekend Edition on KAXC.
Later with these headlines, United Nations sanctions on Iran over its nuclear program are set to be reimposed today after an effort to delay them failed in the Security Council. They were lifted a decade ago as part of the 2015 nuclear deal. France, Germany, and the UK triggered the move when they accused Iran of failing to live up to its commitments. The Trump administration says it will revoke Colombian President Gustavo Petro's visa, taking issue with his remarks at a pro-Palestinian demonstration in New York. He urged U.S. soldiers to disobey President Trump's orders. In a post on X, the State Department called his comments reckless and incendiary. And voters in Moldova are preparing to cast ballots in a parliamentary election against a backdrop of alleged Russian interference. They're set to go to the polls tomorrow. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Okay, here's the pitch to Netflix for a true crime doc from a producer, Dominic Eastwood. His aunt and uncle, Sue and Mal, run a country pub called The Case Is Altered that offers a Monday night trivia quiz. But a new team calling themselves the Shadow Knights becomes so successful, eyebrows are raised, egos are hurt, then a body is found in the river. Emails, WhatsApp, and text messages fly. Who would cheat, much less murder, for a prize that's barely $25? The Killer Question is the new mystery novel by Janice Hallett, former journalist and government speechwriter who joins us now from London. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Scott. It's delightful to be here.
You enjoy a pub quiz yourself, I gather.
Yep, I'm a member of a pub quiz team, and we win sometimes, we come bottom sometimes, and mostly we're mid-table.
They can be important to people?
Well, the quiz team can take on a level of importance that far outweighs its actual subjective importance in the world. Passions run high at the pub quiz, and it's not just about winning, it's about fairness and everyone being equal. And when people perceive that not happening, you know, tempers can run high. And I've seen quite a few altercations, shall we say, that almost end up getting physical.
Over pub quizzes, eh?
Yeah, absolutely. Over questions that are perceived as wrong. If the quizmaster says it's one answer, but a team thinks that the quizmaster is wrong, that can lead to a big row. If a team is considered to be cheating, that's another basis on which fights can break out. It's a lively old world.
Mm. Well, tell us about this new team that appears, the Shadow Knights, and their mysterious leader, known only as the General.
The General, or General Knowledge. The Shadow Knights are an enigma. They roll into the quiz unannounced one day, and, well, they don't not only walk away with the top prize, they get almost top marks. And the next week, they do the same, except they do get top marks. They don't get a single question wrong. And out of several hundred questions, including the marathon, that's a feat that, you know, twitches the radar of Mal, the question setter, and it disgruntles all the other players. So nobody is happy with the Shadow Knights, and Mal determines to find out whether they really are that good or whether they've simply found a way to cheat without him knowing.
Sue and Mal kind of have a secret of their own, don't they?
They do. They once had a past life. They, 5 years earlier, they were police officers in another part of the country. And they were part of a very serious police operation that might have gone catastrophically wrong. And if it did, something might have followed them into this life, because they don't want anyone to know that they used to be members of the police.
Mm. You tell the story through emails and texts. If it's all right with you, I'll be Police Community Support Officer Arthur and you be Mal.
Okay.
Let me begin. Want to know the latest?
You can never know too much, Arthur. Fire away.
Murdered male, pulled deceased from water. By yours, most likely died by single blunt force trauma to the head.
Thanks for keeping us in the loop.
Trained as an actor up north.
Heard he was an actor, yeah.
Couldn't find work. Moved down here. Still couldn't find work, but found drugs and alcohol instead. Got in with a rowdy lot.
Shame.
Seen or heard anything from the others he was with?
Thankfully not.
He's spoken to them now. All profess their innocence and seem quite plausible.
Plausible. That's the sign of a good criminal, Arthur. They look you in the eye and lie without a flicker. Such commitment to the facade of innocence. They believe it themselves.
Oh, my word. I must say, as an old crime reporter, I thought, you know, there's something to that.
I think it's true. I mean, the best liars are the people who convince themselves they're telling the truth.
Yeah. Why did you choose to tell the story in this form? What are the challenges of writing in emails and text messages and WhatsApp messages?
I've written all my novels like this one way or another, and it comes from my past life, actually, as a screenwriter. And if you're a screenwriter, you deliver everything via dialogue. That's character, place, atmosphere, pace. And I've simply adapted that for the page in my novels, and now it comes completely naturally. As for the challenges, occasionally, I do need to communicate to the reader where people are and what people look like. That tends not to be something that we would naturally text about, so I have to find clever ways to get around it. But otherwise, you know, I have a ball writing in that way.
Don't a lot of people use text messages not to reveal but to conceal and misdirect?
I think when we're reading the text messages here, we're reading between the lines all the time. And that's true of life, I think. We're all portraying ourselves in a particular way, whether it's social media, whether it's the short-form communications we're using. We want to come across in a particular way to different people. And that's what I want the reader to unpick in this novel. What do people really mean? In the bit we read, now Mal doesn't always respond very loquaciously to Arthur when he's chatting about the chap who was pulled out of the river. And maybe there's a reason for that, or maybe there isn't.
Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. As a working, highly successful novelist, do you have any concerns about readers of the future just subsisting on text messages and social media posts? And, you know, what we now call literature disappearing?
Well, that's very interesting. Will literature ever disappear? And what is literature in these days? And where is it going? Now, I don't think books are going anywhere, you know, anytime soon. But looking further to the future, who on earth knows? Because we're already getting very, very short formats of communication in our everyday lives. I'm reliably told by young people that nobody emails much anymore. I wrote my first novel, The Appeal, in almost all emails. And that was a piece of feedback I got from my younger readers. Everybody texts now. Emails are for old people. And whereas maybe 40 years ago, we'd have been bemoaning the decline of letter writing, we're now bemoaning the decline of emails. But for the moment, I don't think books or literature are going anywhere. But I think literature might change and more books might be written in the way that I'm writing them now.
The Killer Question, the new novel by Janice Hallett. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Scott. It's been delightful speaking to you.
It's just a jump to the left and a step to the right. The Rocky Horror Picture Show was released 50 years ago. Tomorrow on Weekend Edition Sunday with Ayesha, how today's fans keep Rocky Horror screenings fresh. You can listen
by telling your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. The 2018 Camp Fire was the deadliest California wildfire in history. 85 people died. More than 50,000 were displaced. In August 2021, we interviewed Lizzie Johnson, a reporter who covered the fire and wrote a book, Paradise, One Town's Struggle to Survive an American Wildfire, that included the story of Kevin McKay, a school bus driver.
The morning that the campfire ignited, he got stuck on this bus with two teachers and 22 children, and he had to get them all out of town to safety, and he didn't think they were going to make it.
That story is now told in the new film, The Lost Bus, directed by Paul Greengrass, with Matthew McConaughey as Kevin McKay, and America Ferrera as a teacher, Mary Ludwig.
Kids, this is our bus driver, Kevin. Can we say hi to Kevin? Can I get you in two straight lines, shortest in the front, tallest in the back, and Kevin is going to drive you to Paradise Elementary, where your parents are going to pick you up.
The fire already burns just outside their school's windows. America Ferrera joins us now. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You play a real person, Mary Ludwig. Second grade teacher, I gather from seeing you on the red carpet together that you've gotten to know her at least a little bit. What was it like to help tell her story?
I felt so lucky to get to know her. You know, our producer, Jamie Lee Curtis, who was the catalyst for the film, after she heard maybe your interview with Lizzie.
I have been told, in fact, it was our interview, yes.
Great, yes. Well, she's told the story. She started with, in her great sort of wisdom and instinct, she started with building relationships with Mary and Kevin. When I came on, Mary sat on Zoom with me for hours and talked to me and answered so many questions. And I deeply wanted what was important to her about the journey she'd been on that bus with those children and Kevin to survive in the film.
Yeah.
My Mary on screen, she's been a second grade teacher for 20 years. There's a way to be, and there's a way to respond in an emergency. And the journey is really about shedding all of the sense of control that she's kind of clinging to and surrender to the reality that they're in, which is this raging, monstrous fire that is so much bigger than them.
There's so many scenes of driving through fires and falling power lines. And the screams of children. What was that like to film?
Yeah, it was really tense. I kind of like realized way too late that I had signed on to a horror film. Like, horror is not my genre. I don't like watching horror. Never wanted to be in a horror film. I thought this was just like real deep, true to life drama. And then a third of the way in, I'm like, I signed on to a horror movie. And the way Paul really directed the fire as a monster. You know, it has its own POV, and we're being chased. You know, it's a chase movie. We're being chased by this fire. And that was physically and emotionally taxing in a way that I guess I really underestimated.
I don't need to tell you, of course, that devastating wildfires like the Camp Fire are becoming more common in California. I wonder if that realization weighed on you as you made the film.
I think it was a huge part of why I wanted to make the film. I'm born and raised in Southern California. Wildfires are, you know, not new to me. And I think for anyone paying attention for the last number of years, you know that this is an increasing experience. And the scariest part of it all is how each fire is an unprecedented fire. Each fire is less predictable, less controllable. And that's really the big part of, a really big part of the overstory in the movie is how really good people with really good intentions were very humbled in front of nature. And so all that to say, like, the reality that wildfires are growing in frequency and in unpredictability and in how much damage they're causing was, for me, just a underlining of why making the movie mattered.
Kevin and Mary, and the youngsters for that matter, I mean, they're surrounded by help or people who want to be helpful, but it's called the lost bus because the communications, nobody, the officials don't know where the bus is. Is there a moment when Kevin and Mary decide anyone's going to save us, it's got to be ourselves?
Yeah. For Mary, one of those moments comes when one of the kids is about to pass out and hyperventilating, and that is something that happened.
Okay, don't talk. Very slowly. Try to slow down your breathing.
They'd been in a bus inhaling toxic smoke and fumes, and they were on that bus for a total of 6 hours in real life. That was a 6-hour hell ride.
Kevin, we have to find water or she's going to stroke out.
And these kids are tiny. I mean, the kids on the bus were 5 to 10 years old, if you can imagine. 5. And so their little bodies were suffering, and they didn't have any water. And Mary knew that she had to find water.
No. You need to stay on the bus. Fire comes, you have to drive. Let me go. I can do it. 2 minutes. I'll be right back. I can do it.
Mary and I talked about that moment in real life. It's a little different on screen than it played out in real life, but she did get off the bus, and she said it to me as a point of pride. You know, I think she said it to me as like something that she never imagined she could do.
I found myself thinking about that all the time. These are real-life heroes, people who got up that day like any other morning and wound up risking their lives for others.
And when you factor in that they both had children of their own out in the fire, every instinct, I'm sure, in her body as a mother was to go get her children. What is a hero if not that? And, you know, of course, our first responders are incredible heroes. A number of the firefighters who fought the fires in Paradise on that day were on set. The real Chief Messina, who is a character in the movie, he was on set. He also did a cameo in the back. And making the film felt like an honoring of what the town survived and also how they met the moment and how there were probably hundreds and maybe even thousands of acts of heroism that day, you know, and human resilience and human light. While there were really tough moments, and watching the movie is a nerve-wracking thrill ride, there was a lot of light in making the movie and making it particularly involving a lot of the people who were part of the real events.
America Ferrera, she stars in the new film, The Lost Bus. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Scott.
And this is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Chapter, offering Medicare advice to seniors nationwide and working to find the plans that best fit their needs. Advisors are available by dialing #250 and saying the keyword Medicare Help. And from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. This is NPR.
It is just before 8 o'clock. Good morning. You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota, and operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much for your support. Stay tuned for another hour of Weekend Edition, including the Up North Report, local news from our region. At 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. This week's stories from last weekend's Authentic Voice event. And at 10 o'clock, Jen Buey, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Our weather today, sunny skies, highs in the upper 60s to low 70s, breezy northwest winds 10 to 20. Our lows tonight, 43 to 50, and tomorrow, sunny, highs in the mid to upper 70s. And looking ahead to Monday, sunny and warmer yet with highs 77 to 81. Thanks so much for tuning in to People Powered KAXE.